Hello, this is Rachel Durgan Durga, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the 5th of November issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Deficit soars to $78.3 billion as Carney budget bets big on investment spending while slashing public service, by Tonda McCharles and Alex Ballingall. The Mark Carney government is betting its political fortune on a $581 billion budget that will slash the ranks of the federal public service and add billions for national defense, housing, and trade-boosting infrastructure, while nearly doubling the need to borrow this year alone. The plan takes its title from Carney's campaign slogan, quote, Canada Strong, and is a long-overdue liberal fiscal blueprint to confront the challenge of American tariffs. It also cuts the fiscal anchors the previous liberal government touted as recently as last year, opting to trumpet, quote, generational investments the Prime Minister has promised would transform the Canadian economy and use Ottawa's fiscal firepower to spark a huge wave of public and private sector investment. In a dramatic twist, the Liberals also moved one step closer to ensuring the budget would pass. Shortly after it was presented, an MP broke ranks with the Pierre Poilievre-led Conservatives to join the Liberals Tuesday evening. Even so, whether the budget wins Commons approval will only become clear in the coming days, as Carney's minority government stakes its survival on a document that books more than $141 billion in new federal spending over the next 5 years, a plan Finance Minister François-Philippe Champagne described as an ambitious, once-in-a-generation, quote, investment, end quote, budget. The word austerity never appears. The Conservatives, Bloc Québécois, and the lone Green MP vowed immediately to vote against it unless the budget is substantially amended. But shortly after it was introduced, the Star confirmed that Nova Scotia Conservative MP Chris D'Entremont quit his caucus to sit with the Liberals, bringing the government party's seat count in the House to 170. That means the Liberals only need two more votes to pass the budget and avoid a second federal election in less than a year. By Tuesday night, the NDP's seven MPs had not said how they would vote, with interim leader Don Davies saying the party will take time to decide. Some of its MPs could also abstain. Elsewhere, however, the opposition panned the budget. Poilievre slammed its failure to slash taxes and decried the additional spending as driving up inflation and the cost of living. Conservatives will propose an amendment that, quote, will get rid of the industrial carbon tax, cut the wasteful spending to bring down debt, inflation, and taxes, end quote, he said. The budget booked billions in new spending, with the largest portion, more than $59 billion over the next 5 years, going to defense, as the Carney government bolsters the military to meet new commitments to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Billions more are earmarked for housing, trade-boosting infrastructure like ports and rail lines, and other initiatives, including $5 billion over 3 years for hospital construction. The finance minister said new spending is offset by more than $58 billion in reduced government spending over 5 years, including a cut to foreign aid by $2.7 billion in the next 4 years. The Liberals' plan will slash the public service by 10%, eliminating some 40,000 jobs over the next 3 years. It will trim the growth of pensions for disabled RCMP veterans, a measure for which it booked $5.8 billion over 4 years, and it will save $4.4 billion over 4 years by reducing a federal subsidy for medical cannabis for veterans and RCMP officers. Nevertheless, Champagne projects a significant budget deficit of $78.3 billion this year alone. That's almost double what the Liberal government under Justin Trudeau projected in the December 2024 fiscal update, and exceeds the projection of a $68.5 billion deficit from the independent parliamentary budget officer, who warned in September that Canada's fiscal track was, quote, stupefying, end quote, and, quote, unsustainable, end quote. The budget plots out higher deficits and debt in relation to the size of Canada's economy, blowing past the former government's pledge to restrain deficits beyond 2026 to 27 to 1% of gross domestic product, or GDP, now projecting the deficit will equal 2% of GDP that year. The overall debt-to-GDP ratio will also hit 42.4% this year, the budget said, more than the 41.5% projected last fall. The new fiscal anchors are defined as the decision to stop using borrowed money to pay for day-to-day operational spending within 3 years and instead use it for, quote, capital investments, end quote, that grow the economy as well as a declining debt-to-GDP ratio in the coming years. At a news conference during a media lockup before he tabled the budget, Champagne insisted the nearly doubled deficit is, quote, well within the range that people had expected, end quote. Champagne touted a new suite of measures that would effectively reduce taxes below the levels in the United States and other G7 peers for business that put up money for manufacturing and clean energy production. The government claims this, quote, productivity super deduction, end quote, along with a suite of investment tax credits introduced and expanded in recent years, will spur $1 trillion of private and public sector spending across Canada over the next half decade. Quote, this is a game changer, end quote, Champagne told reporters Tuesday. As promised, the budget does not cut federal funding to provinces, but much of the new spending, including $5 billion over 3 years for new hospitals, is, quote, matching funds, end quote, dependent on provincial spending. Also, as promised, it doesn't cut benefits to most individuals, but it will see 40,000 public service jobs eliminated by attrition, voluntary layoffs, and direct job cuts over the next 3 years. It does not extend new funding for pharmacare expansion, but protects money for health, dental care, and the current drug coverage for those provinces that have already signed on. The budget calculates Carney's decision to cancel an increase to capital gains taxes resulted in $23.5 billion of lost revenue over 5 years, and the decision to scrap a new tax on large digital companies meant the loss of $6.8 billion over 5 years. Quote, it's a budget that Stephen Harper could support, end quote, said David MacDonald, chief economist at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, referring to the former Conservative Prime Minister who cut government costs and the public service. Yet the budget paints a picture with many economic uncertainties. Neither the document nor Champagne's budget speech mentioned Donald Trump by name, but the U.S. president's oversized impact on the global economy, rifts in supply chains, and Canada's dominant trading relationships were cast as a, quote, generational shift, end quote, not just a transition. Quote, the full impact of tariffs and trade uncertainty are still unfolding, and risks remain on multiple fronts, end quote, says the budget, pointing to a consensus among private sector forecasters that the greater risks to the economy are on the downside, not the upside. Quote, greater autonomy is and continues to be the best approach to achieve real resilience, end quote, Champagne argued in his speech to Parliament when he tabled the budget. On defense, the biggest focus of new spending, more than $56 billion over 5 years, is meant to bolster the Canadian military with salary increases, maintenance and repairs of capabilities and infrastructure, upgrades to cyber defense, and spending for new capabilities like armored vehicles, long-range precision strikes, and domestic ammunition production. Another $3 billion over 5 years will bolster Canada's military presence in Latvia, where it leads a group of NATO allies to deter further aggression from Russia after the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. The Carney government outlined a much-touted climate competitiveness strategy that didn't unveil many new measures. Instead, it will lean heavily on a suite of expanded clean technology investment tax credits and as yet unspecified improvements to Canada's industrial carbon pricing systems. The budget also laid out new immigration targets, saying Canada will take in slightly more permanent residents in 2027 than the previously reduced plan the Liberals had outlined. But it will shift the emphasis toward newcomers who will boost the country's economy. Meanwhile, it greatly slashed the number of temporary residents, mainly in the category of international students, reducing their numbers by more than half. Thousands of dog treats sold in Canada recalled over salmonella concerns by Joshua Smith. Two more products from the Alberta-based Puppy Love and Puppy World brand were recalled Tuesday in connection with an ongoing salmonella outbreak tied to dog food and treats in Canada. A total of six of the company's products have been pulled off the shelves over the last week, Health Canada announced Tuesday. The expanded recall now includes five packs of Puppy Love's Beef Junior Ribbon and Canadian Beef Curly Treats, in addition to the same brand's Beef Chews, Chicken Breast, Chicken Wing Tips, and Puppy World's Lamb Lung Treats that were pulled last week. An ongoing Public Health Agency of Canada investigation into the salmonella outbreak revealed the recalled treats contain Salmonella oranienburg, which poses a risk of cross-contamination and illness for those who handle the treats. Puppy Love Pet Products Incorporated, which is based in Fort McLeod, Alberta, has been made aware of six human illnesses in Canada as of last Thursday, Health Canada said in its notice, while cautioning that pet food is not for human consumption. The company reported 22,300 affected units were sold in Canada from February to November. Customers who bought the recalled items are advised to stop using them immediately and to throw them out in regular household trash. The Public Health Agency of Canada's investigation into the salmonella outbreak linked to dog food and treats has logged 32 reports of illness and 8 hospitalizations nationwide as of October 28th, including 2 reports of illness in Ontario. Environment Canada warns of storm surge as winds and high tides combine on British Columbia coast, by the Canadian Press. A series of frontal systems moving over from the Pacific will bring rainfall and coastal flooding for parts of British Columbia's coast, while setting off high water advisories for rivers in some of those areas. Environment Canada has issued a coastal flood warning for much of the east coast of Haida Gwaii, where wind and waves could bring a storm surge 50 centimeters above the highest tides as the two systems move in Wednesday and Thursday. Special coastal flooding statements have also been issued for western and northern Vancouver Island, Greater Victoria, the southern Gulf Islands near Campbell River, and on the northern coast from Hunts Inlet to Farrant Island. Rainfall warnings have been posted for Howe Sound and northern Metro Vancouver, including the North Shore, Coquitlam, and Maple Ridge, with 40 to 70 millimeters of rain forecast through to Thursday. The BC River Forecast Center says the back-to-back storms will push up water levels in coastal areas, including western Vancouver Island, Howe Sound, and the North Shore Mountains. The high stream flow advisory has been issued for those areas, and the center says the heavy rain will bring increased risks of unstable banks, river erosion, submerged roads, swift water hazards, flooding, and landslides. Air Canada ramps up flights at home overseas as travelers shun U.S. by Christopher Reynolds. Air Canada has cemented a pivot away from the U.S. as Canadians continue to shun their neighbor amid the trade war, all as the company recovers from a summer strike that cost it hundreds of millions of dollars. The country's largest airline ramped up flights at home and in Europe, the Caribbean, and Latin America in response to travelers' renewed interest in domestic and overseas trips. Quote, "We mitigated the exposure to reduced demand between Canada and the U.S. In Q3, we quickly responded to Canadians' growing interest to travel domestically," end quote, Chief Commercial Officer Mark Gallardo told analysts on a conference call Wednesday. Quote, Sun and Latin American markets remain solidly ahead of last year for winter, with a robust advanced booking position from Air Canada Vacations, end quote. Quote, the transborder sector remains stable, albeit at lower levels, end quote, he said of the Canada-U.S. travel. Total capacity will nudge up this year, the company said, even as demand for U.S. flights stays weak. The carrier's transborder flight volumes fell 10% year-over-year in September, according to aviation data tracker Cirium. The decline reflects a backlash to the tariff spat sparked by U.S. President Donald Trump, as well as a relatively low Canadian dollar and fears around immigration enforcement in the U.S. Flight volumes rose 3% domestically, 5% for Europe, and 20% for the Caribbean. For Latin America, capacity is poised to increase more than 40% by December, figures from Cirium show. A second hurdle sits in the rearview mirror, leaving a dent in Air Canada's income statement. A three-day strike by more than 10,000 Air Canada flight attendants in August shut down operations, caused more than 3,000 flight cancellations, and cost the airline $375 million, the company said earlier this fall. In the quarter ended September 30, revenue fell more than 5% year-over-year to $5.77 billion due to the strike, which included $90 million in reimbursements to customers, Chief Financial Officer John Diebert said. Net income in the third quarter, typically the company's most lucrative, dropped 87% to $264 million from $2.04 billion in the same quarter last year. Air Canada also cut about 400 management jobs to lighten its cost load after the financial hit. On Tuesday, it narrowed its adjusted earnings forecast to between $2.95 billion and $3.05 billion, compared with the $2.9 billion to $3.1 billion it predicted in September. To recoup some cash, the airline is banking on steady corporate travel and a growing appetite for premium seats, larger ones with more legroom, and enhanced services such as priority boarding and better meals. Quote, demand is strong. In particular, business travel continues to recover, end quote, said Diebert. Chief Executive Michael Russo suggested Prime Minister Mark Carney's push to expand trade in regions ranging from Asia to Europe would prove strong enough to bolster the airline's sales. Quote, we think we can play a big part in that diversification. Strategically bringing in wide bodies will allow us to work with Canada on diversifying trade, end quote, he said, referring to a fleet shuffle that plunks bigger planes onto transatlantic routes. Air Canada expects to add two Boeing 787 Dreamliner jets by the end of 2026, on top of more than three dozen narrow-body planes in a long-awaited fleet renewal. Nonetheless, the carrier will have about a dozen fewer aircraft on any given month in 2026 due to delivery delays, hampering its capacity, Diebert said. On an adjusted basis, the Montreal-based company on Tuesday reported third-quarter earnings of 75 cents per diluted share, down from $2.57 per diluted share in the same quarter last year, and well below analyst expectations of 95 cents per share, according to financial markets firm LSEG Data and Analytics. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In election 2025, the economy's still the main thing, according to the AP voter poll, by Josh Boak, Lindley Sanders, and Amelia Thompson-DeVoe. Economic worries were the dominant concern as voters cast ballots for Tuesday's elections, according to preliminary findings from the AP voter poll. The results of the expansive survey of more than 17,000 voters in New Jersey, Virginia, California, and New York City suggested the public was troubled by an economy that seems trapped by higher prices and fewer job opportunities. And a year after President Donald Trump was brought back to the White House on the promise that he could tame inflation and unleash growth, economic worries were still at the top of voters' minds. despite a rising stock market, inflation remains elevated and hiring has slowed sharply. Since October, a federal government shutdown has only compounded the sense of uncertainty. While Trump has tried to highlight his efforts to deport immigrants in the country illegally and send federal officers and National Guard troops into cities to fight crime, few voters saw these issues as the top concern for the place they live. These broader economic anxieties were accompanied by high discontent in some of the off-year elections. More than half of voters in New Jersey and Virginia said they were, quote, angry, end quote, or, quote, dissatisfied, end quote, with how things were going in the country. The economic challenges have played out in different ways at the local level. Most New Jersey voters said property taxes were a, quote, major problem, end quote, while most New York City voters said this about the cost of housing. Most Virginia voters said they felt at least some impact from the recent federal government cuts. Voters mostly said their own finances were stable, but the poll results suggested that many feel they cannot get ahead in the current economy. That leaves them feeling stuck in place instead of moving up the financial ladder. About 6 in 10 voters in New Jersey, Virginia, and New York City said their families' finances were, quote, holding steady, end quote, but relatively few felt they were, quote, getting ahead, end quote, and about one quarter said they were, quote, falling behind, end quote. About half of Virginia voters who were deciding between Democrat Abigail Spanberger and Republican Winsome Earl Sears said the economy was the most important issue facing their state. Just 2 in 10 pointed to health care, and about 1 in 10 named education or immigration, and fewer than that said crime was the top issue facing the Commonwealth. Most New Jersey voters who were choosing between Republican Jack Cittarelli and Democrat Mickey Sherrill said either taxes or the economy were the top issue in their state. About 1/3 of voters named each of these issues, compared to about 2 in 10 who said this about health care. Less than 1 in 10 identified immigration or crime as top issues. Just over half of New York City voters said the cost of living was the most important issue in the city, as the expense of rent and level of income inequality has climbed in America's most populated city. Democratic nominee Zohran Mamdi is running against Andrew Cuomo, the former New York governor, and Republican Curtis Sliwa. About 1/4 said crime was their major concern. Another 1 in 10 said this of immigration, and less than 1 in 10 pointed to health care or transportation as the top issue. The polling found a high level of discontent about America's direction as a country in several states, a sign that few voters have felt reassured so far by Trump's return to the White House. Democratic-led California asked its residents to vote Tuesday on a plan to redraw the lines of its congressional districts after Trump has pushed Republican states such as Texas to amend its district boundaries in hopes of helping GOP candidates in next year's midterm elections. About half of California voters describe themselves as, quote, angry, end quote, about the direction of the country, with another 2 in 10 saying they were, quote, dissatisfied, end quote. About 6 in 10 voters in Virginia and New Jersey said they are, quote, angry or dissatisfied, end quote, with the way things are going in the country today. Just 1/3 said they are, quote, enthusiastic or satisfied, end quote. Jury deliberates in $40 million lawsuit filed against administrator by teacher who was shot by 6-year-old by the Associated Press. A jury in Virginia began deliberating Wednesday in a $40 million lawsuit filed against a former school administrator accused of ignoring repeated warnings that a 6-year-old had a gun hours before a teacher was shot. Closing arguments were held earlier Wednesday following a week-long trial in the lawsuit filed by former teacher Abby Zwirner against Ebony Parker, a former assistant principal at Richneck Elementary School in Newport News, Virginia. Zwirner was shot in January 2023 as she sat at a reading table in her first grade classroom. Zwirner spent nearly 2 weeks in the hospital, required 6 surgeries, and does not have the full use of her left hand. A bullet narrowly missed her heart and remains in her chest. Zwirner's attorneys said Parker failed to act in the hours before the shooting after several school staff members told her that the student had a gun in his backpack. The case went to the jury after a judge rejected a defense motion for a mistrial. Parker, who was the only defendant in the lawsuit filed by Zwirner. The judge previously dismissed the district superintendent and the school principal as defendants. The shooting sent shockwaves through the military shipbuilding community and the country, with many wondering how a child so young could access a gun and shoot his teacher. An engine fell off a UPS plane before a deadly crash and explosion in Kentucky, the NTSB says, by Bruce Schreiner, Haley Golden, and Dylan Loven. A UPS cargo plane's left wing caught fire and an engine fell off just before it crashed and exploded after takeoff in Kentucky, a federal investigator said Wednesday, offering the first official details about a disaster that killed at least 9 people. First responders, meanwhile, searched for more victims a day after the crash at UPS Worldport, the company's global aviation hub in Louisville. It created an inferno that consumed the enormous aircraft and spread to nearby businesses. After being cleared for takeoff, a large fire developed in the left wing, said Todd Inman, a member of the National Transportation Safety Board, which is leading the investigation. The plane gained enough altitude to clear the fence at the end of the runway before crashing off airport property, Inman told reporters. Airport security video, quote, shows the left engine detaching from the wing during the takeoff roll, end quote, he said. The cockpit voice recorder and data recorder were recovered, and the engine was discovered on the airfield, Inman said. Quote, there are a lot of different parts of this airplane in a lot of different places, end quote, he said, describing a debris field that stretched for half a mile. The plane, with 3 people aboard, crashed about 5:15 p.m. Tuesday, as it was departing for Honolulu from UPS Worldport at Louisville Muhammad Ali International Airport. Video showed flames on the plane's left wing and a trail of smoke. The crash had a ripple effect, striking and causing smaller explosions at Kentucky Petroleum Recycling and hitting an auto salvage yard, Grade A Auto Parts, though it could have been worse, Governor Andy Beshear said. Thankfully, a local restaurant that is right there was missed and now is helping the search and rescue, end quote, Beshear said. Quote, another blessing is this plane could have potentially hit the major Ford factory or the convention center. Those are all close by and did not, end quote. Some people who heard the boom, saw the smoke, and smelled burning fuel were still stunned a day later. Quote, I didn't know if we were getting attacked. I didn't know what was going on, end quote, said Summer Dickerson, who works nearby. Beshear again predicted the death toll would grow, noting that 16 families had gathered at a reunification center for news of loved ones. Quote, I don't know how many victims we're actually looking for, end quote, said Mark Little, chief of the Okolona Fire District in Louisville. Quote, that's one of the issues, and the debris zone is so large. Some of that debris is going to have to be moved and searched underneath. It will take us quite a while, end quote. University of Louisville Hospital said 2 people were in critical condition in the burn unit Wednesday. 18 people were treated and discharged at that hospital or other health care centers. The airport is 7 miles or 11.2 kilometers from downtown Louisville, close to the Indiana state line, residential areas, a water park, and museums. People in the immediate area were told not to drink tap water. The airport resumed operations on Wednesday with at least 1 runway open. Beshear said he didn't know the status of the 3 UPS crew members aboard the McDonnell Douglas MD-11 made in 1991. It wasn't clear if they were being counted among the dead. UPS said it was, quote, terribly saddened, end quote. The Louisville Package Handling Facility is the company's largest. The hub employs more than 20,000 people in the region, handles 300 flights daily, and sorts more than 400,000 packages an hour. quote, "We all know somebody who works at UPS," end quote, Louisville Metro Council member Betsy Rue said, quote, "and they're all texting their friends, their family, trying to make sure everyone is safe. Sadly, some of those texts are probably going to go unanswered," end quote. The governor said the Team Kentucky Emergency Relief Fund, typically used to help people in natural disasters, is accepting donations to help with funeral expenses and other hardships. Quote, "In Kentucky, we grieve together and we support one another," end quote, Bashir said. Eric Richardson stood outside a police training academy where people gathered waiting for word of their missing loved ones Tuesday night. He said his girlfriend, who had been at a metal recycling business near the explosion, wasn't answering her phone. Her phone's live location said she was still there. Bobby Whelan, Richardson's friend, had been in front of her in line, but had left minutes before the explosion. Quote, "We don't even want to think about anything but the best," end quote, Whelan said. Quote, "All our friends were there," end quote. Tom Brooks Jr., who runs a metal recycling business down the street, said the crash, quote, "just rocked the whole place," end quote. Destin Mitchell was working as a host at an Outback restaurant close to the airport when she heard a loud boom. Quote, "People who just sat down to eat got up and left in under 30 minutes and packed up their food because they wanted to hurry up and get home," end quote, she said. Flight records show the plane was on the ground in San Antonio from September 3rd to October 18th. Jeff Gazzetti, a former federal crash investigator, said a number of different things could have caused the fire as the UPS plane was rolling down the runway. Quote, "It could have been the engine partially coming off and ripping out fuel lines, or it could have been a fuel leak igniting and then burning the engine off. It's just too soon to tell," end quote, said Gazzetti, who used to investigate crashes for both the NTSB and the Federal Aviation Administration. He said the crash bears a lot of similarities to a crash in 1979 when the left engine fell off of an American Airlines jet as it was departing Chicago's O'Hare International Airport, killing 273 people. Gazzetti said this UPS plane and the American plane were equipped with the same General Electric engines. The 1979 crash involved a DC-10, but the MD-11 UPS plane is based on the DC-10. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Putin tells officials to submit plans for possibly resuming nuclear tests after Trump's remarks, by the Associated Press. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered officials on Wednesday to submit proposals for a possible resumption of nuclear tests in response to President Donald Trump's statements last week that appeared to suggest the U.S. will restart its own atomic tests. Speaking at a meeting with his Security Council, Putin reaffirmed his earlier statement that Moscow will only restart nuclear tests if the U.S. does so first. But he directed the defense and foreign ministries and other government agencies to analyze Washington's intentions and work out proposals for resuming nuclear weapons tests. On October 30th, Trump appeared to signal that the U.S. will resume testing nuclear weapons for the first time in 3 decades, saying it would be on a, quote, "equal basis," end quote, with Russia and China. But U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright said Sunday that new tests of the U.S. nuclear weapons systems ordered by Trump will not include nuclear explosions. Trump made the announcement on social media while in South Korea, days after Putin announced successful tests of the prospective nuclear-powered and nuclear-capable cruise missile and underwater drone. Putin's praise for the new weapons that he claimed can't be intercepted appears to be another message to Trump that Russia is standing firm in its maximalist demands on settling the conflict in Ukraine. The U.S. military also has regularly tested nuclear-capable weapons, but it has not detonated atomic weapons since 1992. The Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which the U.S. signed but did not ratify, has been observed since its adoption by all countries possessing nuclear weapons, North Korea being the only exception. Putin in 2023 signed a bill revoking Russia's ratification of a global nuclear test ban, which Moscow said was needed to put it on par with the U.S. The global test ban was signed by President Bill Clinton, but never ratified by the U.S. Senate. During Wednesday's Security Council meeting, Defense Minister Andrei Belousov reported to Putin about U.S. efforts to modernize its atomic arsenals, arguing that along with a possible resumption of nuclear tests by Washington, they, quote, significantly increased the level of military threats to Russia, end quote. Belousov suggested that Moscow immediately start preparations for nuclear tests on the Arctic Novaya Zemlya archipelago. He added that the site, where the Soviet Union last tested a nuclear weapon in 1990, was ready for quickly resuming the explosions. Nearly 2,100 Indian Sikhs arrive in Pakistan for annual religious festivities by the Associated Press. More than 2,000 Sikh pilgrims from India arrived Tuesday in eastern Pakistan to join an annual commemoration of the birth of their religion's founder, officials said, marking the first people-to-people contact between the two countries since a brief war in May. The Wagah border crossing, closed for months because of tensions surrounding the border conflict, was reopened by Pakistani authorities to facilitate the pilgrimage, government official Nasir Mushtaq said. The pilgrims arrived in Lahore before traveling to Nankana Sahib, a city in the Punjab province, where the shrine of Guru Nanak is located, he said. Quote, granting visas to Sikh pilgrims and reopening the border demonstrates Pakistan's respect for religious minorities and commitment to fostering cultural ties despite ongoing political disputes, end quote, Mushtaq said. Sikhs are a tiny minority in Muslim-majority Pakistan. Pakistan and India have a history of bitter relations, and tensions between them escalated in April after New Delhi accused Pakistan of supporting militants who launched an attack that killed 26 tourists in Indian-administered Kashmir. Pakistan denied the claim and called for an international investigation. In the months that followed, diplomatic ties were downgraded, border crossings were closed, and the two sides traded cross-border military strikes. The fighting between the South Asian nuclear-armed rivals stopped after U.S. President Donald Trump said he had brokered a ceasefire to prevent a wider conflict. However, the two countries have yet to fully restore diplomatic ties, trade, or the movement of people. U.S. proposes that the U.N. authorize a Gaza Stabilization Force for 2 years, by Sam Mednick, Matthew Lee, and Farnoosh Amiri. The United States has circulated draft text for a U.N. Security Council resolution that would provide a mandate for an international stabilization force in Gaza for at least 2 years, marking the next step in President Donald Trump's plan to halt 2 years of war between Israel and Hamas. The draft, confirmed to the Associated Press by two U.S. officials, is an early template for what would likely be extensive negotiations between members of the 15-member council and other international partners. The officials, who spoke on condition of anonymity due to the sensitivity of the situation, said the draft is being discussed and changed based on those discussions. Arab and other countries that have expressed interest in participating in the stabilization force have indicated that UN backing of the plan is necessary to persuade them to contribute troops. Quote, what we believe is that whatever entity that is created in Gaza should have the legitimacy of a mandate from the Security Council, end quote, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters in Doha. The draft was circulated Tuesday afternoon and has been prepared as a starting point to find consensus that would give the stabilization force and participating countries an international mandate. China and Russia, two of the permanent members of the council, will likely become the biggest opposition for the U.S. as it tries to push through a resolution without either country vetoing it. The draft calls for the force to ensure, quote, the process of demilitarizing the Gaza Strip, end quote, and, quote, the permanent decommissioning of weapons from non-state armed groups, end quote. A big question in Trump's 20-step plan for a ceasefire and reconstruction in the territory is the way to disarm Hamas, which has not fully accepted that step. The draft would give countries participating in the stabilization force a broad mandate to provide security in Gaza through the end of 2027, working with a yet-to-be-established, quote, board of peace, end quote, that would temporarily govern the territory. The draft calls for the force to closely consult and cooperate with Egypt and Israel. The text also says the stabilization troops would help secure border areas along with a Palestinian police force that they have trained and vetted, as well as coordinate with other countries to secure the flow of humanitarian assistance. It also emphasizes the, quote, full resumption, end quote, of aid to Gaza by the United Nations, Red Cross, and Red Crescent, and ensuring that those needed supplies are not diverted. Hamish Falconer, Britain's Minister for the Middle East and North Africa, told the AP recently that the focus for the UK is ensuring the fragile ceasefire holds and that scaled-up aid keeps flowing. He said many questions surround phase two of Trump's plan and that the implementation of the first phase is still unfinished. Falconer said it's important for any stabilization force in Gaza to be, quote, underpinned by a Security Council mandate, end quote. Interpol announces a new global fight against illegal deforestation by Stephen Gratton. Interpol and partners launched a global law enforcement effort Wednesday aimed at dismantling criminal networks behind illegal logging, timber trafficking, and gold mining, which drive large-scale deforestation and generate billions in illicit profits each year. The effort, announced ahead of the UN COP30 climate summit in Brazil, will focus mainly on tropical forests in Brazil, Ecuador, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, and Peru. Quote, criminals are making billions by looting the planet's forests, end quote, Interpol Secretary General Valdeci Iroquiza said in a statement. Quote, the only way to stop them is through determined law enforcement action and strong international cooperation, end quote. This latest phase of the Law Enforcement Assistance Program to reduce tropical deforestation was announced in Rio de Janeiro during the United for Wildlife Global Summit. It is led by Interpol, the international police organization that helps national authorities coordinate and share intelligence, together with the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. It is funded by Norway's International Climate and Forest Initiative. The announcement follows a major crackdown in the Amazon basin last week, when Brazilian police, supported by Interpol, destroyed more than 270 illegal mining dredges operating on the Madeira River. Authorities said the raids dealt a significant blow to criminal groups linked to gold smuggling networks that span Brazil, Bolivia, and Peru. UNODC Executive Director Gahada Wali said illegal deforestation, quote, weakens the rule of law and finances organized crime, end quote, adding that the joint initiative seeks to ensure offenders are held accountable while supporting justice systems and local communities. Launched in 2018, LEAP has evolved from mapping timber trafficking routes to coordinating cross-border investigations and seizing millions of dollars in illicit wood and minerals. Interpol-led operations in Latin America have uncovered hundreds of environmental crimes, including the destruction of hundreds of illegal gold mining dredges in the Brazilian Amazon, and dozens of arrests across 9 countries for logging and wildlife trafficking. Its new phase expands that work to target illegal mining in the Amazon basin, now a leading cause of deforestation and mercury pollution, and to enhance intelligence sharing among enforcement agencies. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Chinese astronauts face delayed return to Earth after spacecraft possibly hit by small debris. A group of Chinese astronauts faces a delayed return to Earth after their spacecraft was believed to be struck by a small piece of debris. Their return, originally scheduled for Wednesday, will be pushed back to an unspecified date, according to state broadcaster CCTV, which offered no further details. The three astronauts from Shenzhou 20 mission flew to the Tiangong Space Station in April and were finishing their six-month rotation. The group consists of team leader Chen Dong, fighter pilot Chen Zhongrui, and engineer Wang Ji. Their replacements on the Shenzhou 21 mission had successfully docked onto the space station on Sunday. China has made steady progress with its space program since 2003. It has built its own space station and has a goal of landing a person on the moon by 2030. Bend a knee like Beckham, soccer star is knighted by King Charles III, by Brian Melly. When it came time to receive his knighthood, soccer great David Beckham knew what to do. He bent his knee like, well, Beckham. King Charles III tapped his shoulders with the blade of a sword, and Bex was transformed to Sir David Beckham. Quote, "This is without doubt my proudest moment," end quote, Beckham said after Tuesday's ceremony at Windsor Castle. Quote, "I've been very obviously lucky in my career to have won what I've won and done what I've done, but to receive an honor like this of a knight is beyond anything that I ever thought I would receive," end quote. The distinction marks the pinnacle of Beckham's effort to rehabilitate his image following events that at times alienated him from fans during a long and distinguished career. He also has had a very public persona as a fashion model, husband to Victoria Posh Beckham of the Spice Girls, and Bend It Like Beckham movie muse. The 50-year-old was knighted for his services to sport and charity, having partnered with UNICEF, the UN's Children's Fund, for two decades, and campaigned with a charity working to eradicate malaria. He also played a pivotal role in London being awarded the 2012 Summer Olympic Games. Nobel Prize-winning novelist Kazuo Ishiguro, author of The Remains of the Day, who previously was knighted, was recognized in Tuesday's ceremony as a Companion of Honor for Literature. Renowned musical singer and actor Elaine Page was given a damehood, the female equivalent of a knighthood. Beckham is the only English soccer player to score at three different World Cups, and his career included the triple-winning campaign of 1999, when Manchester United won the Premier League, the FA Cup, and the Champions League. With 115 appearances for the England national team, Beckham is third on the all-time list. He also captained the side on 59 occasions. After leaving Manchester United in 2003, a move that devastated fans, Beckham played for Real Madrid, Los Angeles Galaxy, and Paris Saint-Germain. He now co-owns the Major League Soccer team Inter Miami. His career hit a low point at the 1998 World Cup in France, where Beckham was widely vilified for his petulant kick of Argentina player Diego Simeone, which saw him sent off and left the team short a player. Many fans blamed him for England's exit. In 2023's Netflix documentary series Beckham, he described the abuse he experienced, which included an effigy of him hanging from a noose outside a London pub. Quote, "I knew it was bad at the time, but going over that whole thing was quite a tough one," end quote, he told the Associated Press at the time. Beckham's knighthood was announced in June during the King's Birthday Honors List. The awards, which are also given out at New Year's, recognize contributions to British life. Prescription painkiller shortage in Canada expected to continue into New Year, by Hannah Alberga. Pharmacists say a shortage of medications that contain oxycodone is expected to continue into the new year, while supply of another type of painkiller has increased since a nationwide disruption in the summer. In July, Health Canada sent out a notice about a shortage of drugs that contain acetaminophen with oxycodone, which includes those by the brand name Percocet. There was also a shortage of acetaminophen with codeine, which includes Tylenol 3. It was supposed to last until early fall, caused by manufacturing disruptions. These medications are prescribed to treat a range of ailments, from those enduring acute injuries to chronic back pain. Saada Faisal, Senior Director of Professional Affairs at the Canadian Pharmacists Association, said the codeine-containing medications, such as Tylenol 3, are back in stock. Supply is still limited for Tylenol 2 and 4, which she said are prescribed less often. The shortage of drugs containing acetaminophen with oxycodone are ongoing, and Faisal said the manufacturer has indicated some supply will be available in December, though there will be constraints because of back orders. Quote, "We are hoping that by the new year the situation will improve," end quote, Faisal said. She said there are other pain medications with similar ingredients that health providers can prescribe as alternatives. Mina Tadros, an associate professor at the University of Toronto's pharmacy faculty, said switching a patient's painkiller can take a lot of time and resources, placing pressure on an already stretched system. Quote, "Talking to pharmacists and a team early before you run out of medications is so important because no one wants to be dealing with it the day that you have nothing left," end quote, Tadros said. At any given time, there are between 1,500 and 2,000 active drug shortages in the country, according to the Canadian Pharmacists Association. Tadros said it's when shortages hit commonly used medications that the repercussions are felt on a larger scale. Quote, "When a shortage happens or some supply chain break happens, it's sort of like a slow-moving train. That takes time and then kind of hits," end quote, Tadros said. Quote, "The problem is, once it's depleted, it also takes months to replenish it," end quote. Budget includes CBC funding boost, pitches getting Canada into Eurovision, by Anja Karadeglia. The Liberal government's plans for CBC Radio Canada include looking at getting Canada into the Eurovision International Song Contest. A line in the new federal budget section on CBC says the government is working with the public broadcaster to explore participation in the popular song contest. Eurovision, which has been running for decades, features performers from various countries and is coordinated by the European Broadcasting Union. The federal budget, tabled Tuesday, includes the $150 million funding increase for CBC Radio Canada, the Liberals promised in the federal election campaign. The budget says Ottawa will look at ways to modernize the public broadcaster's mandate to strengthen its independence. The fiscal plan also includes about $400 million in funding for various cultural organizations and funds. The money will go to the Canada Music Fund, the Canada Media Fund, Telefilm Canada, and the National Film Board, as well as a component of the Canada Periodical Fund earmarked for small and community news outlets. The budget says the funding is meant to, quote, "grow Canada's creative industries and help Canadian talent succeed in an increasingly digital and global marketplace," end quote. It also includes a change to copyright laws which would ensure the creator of an original visual artwork receives a royalty when their work is resold. The 1 billion Grand Egyptian Museum opens to the public, by the Associated Press. The Grand Egyptian Museum opened its doors to the public on Tuesday after an extravagant inaugural ceremony attended by royals and heads of state. The $1 billion megaproject has been promoted as the world's largest museum dedicated to a single civilization, with nearly 50,000 artifacts. For the first time, visitors can marvel at the collection of treasures from the tomb of the famed King Tutankhamun, which was discovered in 1922. Quote, "Most Tutankhamun treasures were in the old Egyptian museum," end quote, Ahmed Gonaim, the museum CEO, told reporters. Quote, "However, some were scattered in other museums and others were kept in storage. Bringing all those treasures in one place enriches the museum display experience," end quote. Visitors flock to the Monarch's Gallery that houses over 5,000 artifacts, including jewelry, gilded chariots, and his gold death mask. Quote, "It was amazing, especially the mask," end quote, said Nicholas Vulgarakis, a tourist from Greece. The museum, located near the pyramids at the edge of Cairo, is expected to boost Egypt's tourism revenues and help invigorate the country's troubled economy. Quote, "We expect 7 million visitors a year," end quote, said Ghonaim, adding that a daily cap of 20,000 visitors will be enforced to ensure a smooth experience for all. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi inaugurated the museum over the weekend after nearly 2 years of a soft debut where visitors had access to parts of the museum. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the 5th of November issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Rachel Durkin-Durga. Thank you for listening.